skills were not necessarily a bar to progress. Clubs, too, felt emboldened to look past prior playing experience. On the whole, the World Cup shook German football out of its staidness and strengthened the hand of reformers. Within weeks, many of Jürgen Klinsmann's most controversial methods, more proactive goalkeepers who enabled a higher defensive line, core stability exercises with American fitness coaches, a strong emphasis on personality development, and help from sports psychologists, became accepted practice in the top flight. For Klopp, working with ZDF offered an opportunity to closely study the games of international teams who were rarely seen on German screens. The time on stage also delivered a couple of other valuable lessons to him. Firstly, he recognised the potential of the new visual aid and was quick to utilise the touchscreen technology for his own work at Mainz. That was his second question in 2005. "Can I use that on my laptop in the changing room?" says Derling. The first question was, "Where is the loo?" Klopp's clever like that. He thinks about things. He's not one of these coaches concerned with lining his pockets as much as possible in a short space of time. He cared about making things work, about getting the maximum out of it, maximum fun, maximum use. He wanted to learn. No one really knew the possibilities of that system at the time. No one was working with anything like that in the Bundesliga. We made it possible for him, and it was great for us that he used it during the season, because that made him better when it came to doing it on TV at the World Cup. It was Peter Krawitz's job to put together the clips for use at half-time or in pre-match team talks at Mainz. A second realisation concerned the power of the crowd to push a team to its limits and beyond. Like many experts, Klopp had been sceptical about the national Mannschaft's chances at both competitions, Derling says. Everyone knew that Klinsmann wasn't the world's best tactician, and we all underestimated the influence of his assistant, Lau. Germany's success came as a surprise. I suspect that Klopp picked up on the difference motivation made. Motivation had carried the team past the odd tactical weakness and the odd deficiency in tradecraft. Klopp had always played with the support of the crowd, but at the World Cup he saw how the crowd could really play the game. That's what happened against Poland. Substitute David Odenkor, surfing on a wave of euphoria, put in the cross of his life to decide the game. Pure spirit. You could see the same thing when Klopp whipped up the crowd for Liverpool's game against Borussia Dortmund. The Anfield crowd carried the inferior team that night. They even scored the decisive goal for them. Grushvid sounds as if he's about to well up, reminiscing about those summers working with Klopp. "He was an incredible team player," he says. "He didn't just turn up shortly before we went on air, but got involved hours before, giving his thoughts. There were long discussions about what should be shown. He left nothing to chance. On days off, we went out to eat together. He wanted to be a genuine part of the team. He truly was one of us. There's no other way to put it." That is not to say that there wasn't the occasional ill-tempered outburst. The day before the World Cup, an angry Klopp kicked a hole in one of the paper walls at the studio reception and shouted at people as the system had failed. "But that was okay, no problem," says Derling. He did that once because he wanted things to work well, outstandingly well. He always said, "Let us put something together that works outstandingly well tomorrow." He was interested in the job, not in looking good on television. So he lost it once, and everybody ran a bit quicker as a result. And the damn thing worked, and everybody had a good time. And Klopp mentioned these people's name on air, the ones who worked behind the scenes, to make them feel part of it. "Mike, roll the tape," he'd say. The bosses told him that wasn't the done thing on TV, but Klopp didn't care. His popularity approached the levels of the national team and their coaches in those days. People stopped to take pictures with him and ask for autographs outside the stadium in Berlin. German FA president Dr. Theo Schweinsteiger joked at a get-together of Bavarian coaches that his aunt had told him to appoint Klopp, the guest of honour at the event, as the next Bundestrainer. At Mainz's first off-season friendly after the tournament, the stadium announcer in the minuscule Bad Gürgen ground introduced Klopp as that famous guy from television and asked him whether he'd continue working in football. The Mainz coach warily acknowledged that people needed a mug to represent and symbolise the club, but railed against being the sole focus of attention. Eyewitnesses at the game reported that many fans wanted Klopp's autograph, but nobody asked any of the Mainz players for theirs. The ZDF coverage of the World Cup won the German TV Award for Best Sports Programme in November 2006. Klopp's contract with the channel was extended to Euro 2008. 2 years later, he won the German TV Award again for his punditry at the 2010 World Cup for RTL. More coveted trophies would follow not long after. Chapter 14. 60,000 Tears. Mainz 2007-2008. In May 2007, a few weeks after Jurgen Klopp's first relegation as player or manager, he was running a youth hostel in rural Thuringia, right in the former death strip of the inner German border. Temporarily. Klopp had taken the Mainz 05 squad to a similar no-mod-cons hut for a team-building exercise 4 years earlier, in the run-up to the promotion-winning 2003-04 season. The back-to-the-woods trip with the 2007-08 players was supposed to have the same positive effect and outcome. 30 men were sleeping on bunk beds in one room. The day started at 6 in the morning, with Klopp blaring out German Schlager classic Guten Morgen Sonnenschein on a boombox. I'll never forget that, says Nevin Subotic. Even though he can't remember quite whether that oral pleasure consisted of the original acoustic version by Greek singer Nana Mouskouri or Irene Shear's cover from 1989. We were totally shot every morning, but we had to get up, make our own breakfast, prepare lunch and dinner, peel the carrots, that sort of thing. Midfielder Miljorad Pekovic was injured. He couldn't join in the exercises. Games in the woods where we had to cooperate to achieve a common goal. So he was mother of the group. He stirred the gigantic soup pot for a few hours until everybody came back in for lunch. A stone's throw from the modest lodgings, a section of the wired fence, a guard tower and a museum reminded the visitors of Germany's division. The players, as much as they're susceptible to such associations, could understand the choice of the team base as symbolic. Mainz 05 are keen to cross the same border that they recently had crossed in the opposite direction due to relegation, wrote Die Welt. In physical terms, Klopp joked they had already crossed the line during the training camp. The 40-year-old saw the step back down as an opportunity to hone his tradecraft. In the second division, the playing style, the work of the coaching staff, has a much bigger influence on success and failure than in the Bundesliga, where individual quality by the opposition can ruin the best plan, he said. A good run, Die Welt suspected, might enable Klopp to cross a personal line to a new club afterwards. The city of Mainz kept the faith. All 15,000 season tickets were sold, and locally based credit company Coface agreed to buy the naming rights to the modern first-class football stadium, costing 60 million euros, capacity 35,000, that the council were planning to build on a brownfield site, a 5-minute drive outside town, not far from Klopp's domicile in Gonsenheim. Three of last season's best performers, Manuel Friedrich, Leon Andreasen, Mohamed Zidane, did not go down with Mainz. There was an almost entirely new midfield in Miroslav Kahan, the Slovakian international, and former VfL Wolfsburg stalwart Tim Hoogland, Schalke, and Daniel Günkel, NRG Cottbus. And a teenage centre-back who, by playing with the coolness of a much older head, quickly made himself indispensable, Subotic. Having had a taster of first-team action in the Bundesliga denouement against Bayern, the Serbian rapidly improved to play 33 out of 34 games in the second division, making very few mistakes. He credits Klopp's careful but not always gentle handling of him for his good performances. Klopp has a very broad spectrum, he says. He could be very harsh, I thought. Hey, this guy's screaming at me. Chill, dude. But I probably needed it then. He'd be better placed to judge that. That side of him was old school, a hard school. But there were also these moments when he came up to me and asked, everything okay? If there's anything you need, let us know. We want to help. We're there for you. We want you to play well. He was like a colleague in that sense, not like a superior. I felt I could approach him. That took away a lot of my insecurities. I was a teenager, on my own, on a different continent, in a flat, getting paid to play football. Ridiculous, really. It was a very strange situation. The last thing you need is a coach telling you, you have to perform now, otherwise you'll be gone next year. I was given time to grow. The decibel levels might have gone up from time to time at the training ground, but Klopp's censure would always be directed at the players, not the person, Subotic explains. Getting shouted at was always like hearing an alarm bell for me. I knew I'd made a mistake then, that I could have done better. It was always respectful, never the kind of insults you'd sometimes hear from Bundesliga 2 coaches. That stuff made you piss yourself with laughter. Watching many of the training sessions from the sidelines, Derling didn't notice anything out of the ordinary in the way Klopp addressed his players. But if you saw how they reacted to him during the game, you immediately realised that they'd found a way to communicate with him in the dressing room. You cannot treat everybody the same way. That's social intelligence. You have to gauge how you have to talk to somebody. I'm sure he sometimes hits the wrong note, but mostly he got it spot on. These stories that you hear of some other top coaches, they don't talk to players for weeks or kill them in front of the group, you never heard of Kloppo. He didn't play those games. With Klopp, it was all very humane, Subotic confirms. I knew these things were said for a reason, for motivation, as a means to an end to get to the top. Klopp had it both, the rough and the smooth. There were two different sides to his Mainz team too that year. 05 started the season well with a 4-1 win against Koblenz. Three defeats against the league's better teams, bogey side Grote Fürth, 3-0, Kickers Offenbach, 2-0, coached by Klopp's mentor Wolfgang Frank, and TSG Hoffenheim, 1-0, an expensive ensemble under the expert direction of Ralf Rangnick. In the following seven matches, offered a glimpse of possible shortcomings, however. They went into the winter break in second place on 31 points, a whisker ahead of Köln Freiburg, both on 30. Fürth, 29, and 1860, 28. On the 9th of January, 2008, Klopp's mobile phone rang. Unknown number. Heidel, sitting next to him at the winter training camp hotel in Costa Balena, Spain, immediately knew it was important. Klopp sat up straight, nodding, yes, yes, like a good boy. Bayern's general manager, Uli Hoeneß, was on the line. The most powerful man in German football was calling Mainz 05, was calling Klopp. The record title holders were in the market for a new manager to succeed veteran Ottmar Hitzfeld for the next season. Hoeneß. We're looking at a big international option, and at a smaller German one. You are the German option. Can you see yourself coming here in case we decide to go for the German option? We can talk about it, Klopp replied demurely. I told him he had to go for it, Heidel says. I said, you're absolutely crazy if you don't do it. Their relationship was so close, he adds, that Klopp always confided in him about approaches from other clubs. Bayern's advances were hugely alluring. Klopp was aware he was only second choice for the Allianz Arena role, a backup contender if the Bavarians' complex, highly secret negotiations with the unknown international heavyweight were to fail. But that didn't do too much to lessen his disappointment when Hoeneß phoned again with bad news 2 days later. We have decided to go with the other Jürgen, the Bayern patriarch declared. What other Jürgen? Klopp replied, dumbfounded for a moment. He had thought Germany's biggest club had worked on reeling in a foreign supercoach. But the big international option, it now transpired, was California-based Jürgen Klinsmann, the former German national team manager. Heidel. Hoeneß added that Bayern's choice was quite similar to you, Mr. Klopp. He didn't really admit it, but I could see that it was a bit of a blow for him. He was a little hurt. Mainz reporter Reinhard Reinberger later recalled Klopp taking training in a bad mood that day. But he quickly got over it, Heidel says. Klopp's very good at overcoming setbacks. As much as the Mainz coach was irked by losing out to his namesake and fellow Swabian, this was a defeat that turned into a win before too long. Hoeneß's public confirmation that Klopp, the second division coach, who had presided over relegation 7 months earlier, had been a very serious alternative for the most glamorous job in German club football, amounted to his beautification, Frankfurter Rundschau wrote. He wrongly used to get reduced to being a motivational guru, with talent for PR honed as a TV expert. His selection as a contender to succeed Hitzfeld by itself has directed attention towards other qualities of his. Bayern thinking about me was an honour, Klopp said. In Heidel's view, Bayern didn't have the balls to opt for a coach without a top football background, ignoring the fact that Klopp was a much more experienced manager than Klinsmann at the time. I was talked into trying out the Klinsmann adventure, a rueful Hoeneß later admitted. We signed up the wrong Jürgen. We all know that was a big mistake. Klinsmann's reformist agenda, while convincing on paper Hoeneß, failed to win over the team and the club due to a severe lack of tactical detail. The former VfB Stuttgart striker was fired 10 months into his first season, with Bayern in danger of missing out on the Champions League. In the second half of the season, Mainz's results continued to be decent, without ever building up any real momentum. Klopp's men were easily the best footballing side behind Borussia Mönchengladbach and Hoffenheim, patient on the ball and technically much more sophisticated than the vast majority of opponents. That superiority, unfortunately, translated into a bit of complacency. Games that should have been won were drawn. Games that should have been drawn were lost. But Mainz never lost touch with the promotion places, and Klopp's marketability was not damaged by his team's underwhelming run either. On the contrary, encouraged by Bayern's early inquiry, a number of Bundesliga clubs thought that FSV's uncertain prospects might make it easier for them to prise Klopp away from his natural habitat at the Braunschweig. One FC Köln, coached by the idiosyncratic Christoph Daum, who had missed out on getting appointed as Germany's national team coach after failing a drugs test in October 2000, got in touch. Heidel. Things were always open and transparent between us. Kloppo said to me, I'm going to meet with Köln sporting director Michael Mayer. I don't really want to go there, but I want to hear what they'll say. I want you to know that. I said, no problem. Go and listen to him. You're only going to find out how good life is for you at Mainz. But please make sure no one finds out. Just like Heidel predicted, the secret rendezvous at one of Meyer's relatives' homes in Frankfurt came to nothing. Klopp had left the meeting deeply unimpressed. Köln, a promotion rival, later brazenly complained that Mainz were trying to seed discord by falsely claiming that Meyer contacted Klopp, which led to Heidel making the failed approach public. That February, a senior delegation from Hamburger SV, sporting director Dietmar Didi Biersdorfer, CEO Bernd Hoffmann and marketing and communications director Katja Kraus also visited the Klopps at their house in Gonsenheim. Over pizza, cake and coffee, the Northerners probed the Mainz coach's willingness and suitability to take over at one of the historic greats of the league for the next season. Hoffmann and Kraus were certain that they had found their man, a young, energetic manager who would make the fairly expensively put together side a championship contender once more. Biersdorfer was less sure. Could a club of HSV's stature appoint a coach nicknamed Kloppo? The former defender wondered in Klopp's presence. You have a sporting director called Didi, don't you? The Mainz coach shot back with a smile. Scouts were instructed to discreetly watch Klopp and other candidates for the posts such as Bruno Labbadia and Dutchman Fred Rutten and Martin Jol at work. The results were collected in a dossier and presented at a board meeting. Klopp's coaching and brand of football were much commended by HSV's spies, but also noted that he had been unshaven, late for training, dressed in shabby jeans, and talked rudely to the local sports reporters. A typical Hamburg story, says Heidel, shaking his head. Holes in his trousers, they said. This rumour that he was late for training? Jürgen Klopp was never late for training, not once in all those years. And they said he was brash with journalists. Yes, he was. He'd known these guys for 15 years, was on first-name terms with all of them. They'd already slaughtered him as a player. They were like friends. When he said to them, you fucking lost your mind, in a press conference with no camera running, they knew exactly how to take that. But those guys from Hamburg were like, oh my God, you can't go to Hamburg. Impossible. Klopp was not pleased when the scouts' findings were relayed to him. Those who work in football should have known how I work and the way I look. You don't have to put a scout on the touchline for that. That's amateurish, he said to Bildam Sontag in 2011. It hurt me to hear I wasn't punctual. There's probably no one more punctual than me. Unshaven, only that much was true. I called Mr. Biersdorfer and said, if you're still interested in me, I decline. Please never call me again. Hamburg's failure to land Klopp, the most promising German coach of his generation, has become part of German football folklore. The Bundesliga's version of Decca Records boss Dick Rowe turning down the Beatles. Whether Klopp's casual demeanour really did tip the scales against him is somewhat doubtful, however. A former HSV official who was directly involved in the search privately insists that Jol, who had led Tottenham Hotspur to fifth place in 2006-07, was out of contract, had simply been considered the better choice by a majority on the board, irrespective of Klopp's sartorial shortcomings. Either way, after initial success under Jol, who made it to the UEFA Cup and the DFB Pokal semi-final in 2008-09, HSV soon came to regret their decision. We might not have reached the Champions League final with Klopp in charge, but I'm sure the club would have been in a better position now, a mournful Hoffmann told Sportbild in 2014. Biersdorfer, too, admitted to having a few sleepless nights over missing out on Klopp. By the time he left Dortmund in 2015, Hamburger SV had appointed 12 different coaches, including Labadia for two spells, traded stints in Europe for regular relegation battles, and turned into a byword for serial incompetence. Back in April 2008, media chatter about Klopp's unresolved future, he was out of contract in June, was reaching a crescendo. Mainz ultras were so worried the coach might leave that they disobeyed a pre-season agreement not to call him over to their section for the customary humbar singing session after the final whistle. Klopp had wanted the players to be the sole focus of the crowd's praise. But after the 3-0 win in the derby against SV Verein Wiesbaden on match day 27, the chant, "Jürgen to the fence," went out again and again, until finally the coach relented. The show of adulation from the terraces was an obvious attempt to sway Klopp's decision. "I understand their cause, that's why I agreed to sing with them," he said, adding that he was well aware of the strength of feeling in the stadium. A couple of days later, Klopp told reporters that he had made up his mind. He would sign a new contract with the club if they were promoted back to the Bundesliga for the next season. "We had plenty of emotional discussions and agreed that failure to go up would be a good time to part ways," he said. The newspapers recorded Klopp's declaration as a clear "Jein" to his club. It was both a "Ja" and a "Nein." The immediate outlook for Mainz, however, remained sunny, with a high chance of stubbles. With three games to go, FSV was second in the table, 2 points ahead of Hoffenheim. Klopp demanded that the crowd at the Braunschweig made themselves heard in the home game against Alemannia Aachen. Mainz's chief propagandist, Süddeutsche Zeitung, got his wish. The atmosphere was crackling under the floodlights, the stadium louder than it had been for a long time, Rehberg and Kahn wrote. But it was one of those games. 05 created plenty of opportunities and took none. An Aachen counterattack 15 minutes from time found the net. Mainz fell down to fourth spot. 3 days hence, after an injury-ravaged team had slumped to a 2-0 defeat at 1 FC Köln, they were in the same place. There was still hope, still a possibility. Third place Hoffenheim had to lose or draw against Greuther Fürth. Mainz had to beat St. Pauli. Klopp's last game as FSV coach finished with a 5-1 win over the self-styled punk football club from Hamburg. Hoffenheim had beaten Fürth 5-0. They went up to the Bundesliga. Mainz stayed down. 18 years of Jürgen Klopp at the Braunschweig, just under 11 as a player, just over 7 as a manager, ended in silent desperation, football's worst feeling, total powerlessness. Nothing he or his team could have done that day would have been enough to lift Mainz to the Bundesliga and prolong the liaison between club and coach. 20,000 fans in the stadium stood up to serenade the sobbing manager with "You'll Never Walk Alone." Klopp only managed 2/3 of the lap of honour before breaking down in tears. He escaped to the dressing room, sprinting across the pitch, away from the sadness. "For Mainz, it's the beginning of a new world that we never wished for," Heidel said. "If it was up to me, we could have continued working together for another 10 years. 30,000 people turned up on the Gutenberg Platz the following Friday evening to give Klopp a second, happier send-off. Earlier that day, he had been unveiled as the new Dortmund coach. Back in his football hometown, Klopp's voice crumbled under the weight of tears. "Everything I am, everything I can do, you have made possible for me. Everything," he stuttered on stage. "People were crying," says Subotic. "Grown-ups, women, children, toddlers who didn't understand what was going on were crying too, because everybody was crying." The farewell do showed once more how many emotions he stirred up, how he brought people together. I'd seen him celebrating, I'd seen him lost in thoughts before. But this was a different side to him. It wasn't sorrow, it was affirmative. His life's work was being recognised. He was the star of the team, the main protagonist of an extraordinary story. That night, you could see how much he meant to the whole city. It was very touching, unforgettable. In terms of saying goodbye, Kloppo's number one in the world ranking, Heidel says proudly. I don't know of any coach getting that kind of send-off, with a stage in the city centre and 30,000 people all there for one single person. Usually, coaches are fired at the end, or they leave, somehow, with a bouquet of flowers in their hands. At Mainz, it was very dramatic, with a huge banner. "Thank you, Kloppo." It was the most emotional farewell imaginable, and I don't say that just because I organised it. Klopp assured the 05 faithful that he would never forget them and happily celebrate Mainz's promotion in the city square from a different vantage point next season. He thanked Christian Heidel and Harald Strutz for giving me the chance to choose my dream vocation, then castigated an unnamed local paper for printing critical statements by some morons about his successor, Norwegian Jørn Andersen, and threatened that they won't get any interviews anymore. It might have sounded churlish and off-colour to the uninitiated, but the 40-year-old merely reiterated a point he had stressed over and over to reporters in the past. A club of Mainz's stature and means, he lectured on stage, could only succeed if everybody is pushing in the same direction, if everybody takes the giant heart of this city in their own hands when going into the stadium or watching Mainz at home to really cheer us on, or to step on the gas and to support us with all their might. If we haven't learned that lesson after these 18 years here, I don't know anymore. Subotic remembers the evening well for a second, more personal reason. In the midst of the sentimental festivities, Klopp cornered him to lay the groundwork for the defender's move to Dortmund with him. He had 10 million things to think about that night, so I thought the last thing he needs is me to congratulate him on his beautiful farewell and ask, "How's it going? How do you feel?" But he came up to me and said, "If you want to go somewhere else one day, call me before." There were 30,000 people there, his family, friends, all the players he'd ever coached and everybody's grandmother on top of that, but he took a few minutes to talk to me. I felt amazing. I'll never forget that moment, especially under these circumstances. He had already had a drink, that's fair to say. He deserved it too. It wasn't a memorial ceremony, but a celebration. And it changed my life forever. Chapter 15. In Times of Fading Light. Dortmund 2013 to 2015. Borussia Dortmund had pushed the best team in Europe extremely close in the 2013 Champions League final at Wembley. And yet, the 25-point gap behind Bayern Munich at the end of the Bundesliga campaign posed an uncomfortable question. Why had Dortmund lost so much ground domestically? 2-1-all draws in the league games against the treble winners suggested an inability to beat the lesser lights had been the main issue. Klopp and his coaching staff believed the answer was not change, but more of the same. Better and faster. We want to build a new pressing machine, he announced, before heading into the summer holidays. Mario Götze joined up with Pep Guardiola. Robert Lewandowski didn't just yet. Bayern's unwillingness to make a suitable offer to sign the Polish forward before his contract at the Signal in Iduna Park was due to expire in 2014 chilled relations between the clubs to well below freezing. Matthias Sammer, the former Borussia icon turned Bayern sporting director, attracted special opprobrium. If I were him, I'd thank God that someone had the idea of hiring me every time I walked into the Bayern training ground, Klopp said. I don't know if Bayern would have got one fewer point without Sammer. Jürgen has got this ability to nail the head on the head, Dortmund CEO Hans-Joachim Watzke says. When he said that thing about Sammer, 200 people told me, finally, somebody dared to say it. Without fear of any recriminations. He doesn't care. He's fearless in these moments. He doesn't care what others might say. Sometimes he goes too far, but that makes him even more likable in my view. The unresolved Lewandowski situation did zap some of our energy that year, Watzke confesses. However, even if the player himself was scarcely affected by the unedifying tug of war, he would notch up 20 goals in the season, winning his first Torjäger Kanon, the trophy for the leading goalscorer. An emphatic, brilliantly engineered counter-attack victory 4-2 over newly arrived Bayern coach Pep Guardiola in the German Super Cup held out hope for another exciting season. And Klopp's pressing machine 2.0 with shiny add-ons Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Henrik Mkhitaryan were soon pumping out wins in the Bundesliga too. Dortmund were only 1 point off the Bavarians at the top of the table 11 games in. Then the mood darkened. A loss to Wolfsburg brought attention to a lengthy injury list. Was the Klopp team's high-intensity, super-athletic playing style to blame, one journalist inquired in the pre-match press conference, for Bayern's visit to Westfalia? A disgusting question, the coach sneered on the podium, with barely controlled rage. We are a team that gives their everything. You've all praised us for that countless times. Klopp pointed to a more convoluted fixture list. Half a dozen of his players had become German internationals, as well as to increased pressure as reasons for the physical complaints. Bayern have injuries too, but they can compensate them better, he added. The harsh tone of his reply left little doubt that he was personally offended by the suggestion. It was also dangerous, threatening the team's morale, he stressed. The moment your coverage manages to take away the player's appetite for movement, we'll automatically face tough times. And the tough times were coming. Bayern's 3-0 win at the Signal Iduna Park, a game that swung on the opener by substitute Mario Götze, of all people, ushered in a spell of poor results. Dortmund finished a shit final third of the year. Klopp, in a disappointing fourth spot, 12 points behind leaders Bayern, who had a game in hand. Dortmund missed too many chances and had problems creating openings against teams who were happy to sit deep. It became clearer than ever before that as tactical trailblazers, they had made a rod for their own back. Even newly promoted teams who were individually not on the same page had learned to adopt smart countermeasures. You play the same ball you played the year before, but the opponents are there. You play the ball again, and they're there again, Subotic recounts. It's always harder if you're forced to play through opponents rather than to concentrate on the transition, says Hummels. We found it tough going. An increasingly curt and irritated Klopp refused to believe that the problem was a lack of Plan B, as countless media observers claimed. The issue, he insisted, lay with the application, not strategy. And the injuries? Simply bad luck. Or maybe not. Some wondered whether the rot had set in due to the departure of athletics coach Oliver Bartlett in 2012. But that explanation is not corroborated by any of the players or BVB officials who contributed to this book. Unsurprisingly, things got a little disquiet in training, says Herman Hummels. It wasn't always nice, but it's normal. Being with a coach for such a long time, it's like being in a relationship. There's a tension. It's unavoidable. There were arguments about tactics, too. Some of the more experienced players were possibly a little less receptive to the run-run mantra they had been before. Subotic. When you get the feeling as a player that you've already achieved something, that you have a bit of experience, you suddenly don't want to say yes to everything anymore. I guess that's human nature. If it was necessary, Klopp upped the volume. He shook us up a bit to wake us up. Not by saying, you have to play something different, boys, it'll be tough. No. He went up to a player and slapped him across the face. You think, oh, he might slap him back. That was a rougher move. But you knew he didn't do it to let off steam, but to up the intensity. We understood. And that aggression was always contained, never uncontained. That wouldn't have worked. There were confrontations, and it sometimes became personal. But that's okay too, says Gundogan. The important thing is to agree on a joint way forward afterwards, so that there's no lingering resentment. With Kloppo, there were never any open questions left at the end. We always managed to get everything out of the way. There was a popular misconception that the Borussia manager was the player's best friend at the time, Watzke explains. Jürgen was more than a coach for everyone, but not a brother, not the caring, slightly older colleague either. He commanded great authority, and it wasn't always as matey as it looked. He could change his tune. He's unpredictable. He can explode from one moment to the next, smashing everything to pieces. But he always managed to keep everything under wraps somehow. Dortmund, like all the best families, kept their squabbles in-house. Disagreements never went beyond the changing room. There was no falling out. The giddy teenage love affair between Klopp and his players of the previous years had evolved into a more regular relationship with customary ups and downs. But the mutual adoration itself was still very much there. Klopp treated his men like a strict father would, making life uncomfortable to bring out their best, not to shift blame onto them or vent his frustrations. He never briefed against his players to the media, never played games. It was always about football, and everyone knew exactly where they stood with him, says Subotic. The coach's deep personal connection with the supporters remained strong too. When BVB ultra Jan-Henrik Grzeszewski approached Klopp with a plea to auction off one of his baseball caps in support of a crowd-funded film about Borussia's founding father, Franz Jacobi, he refused, flat out. But then he immediately said, we can do much better than that. I'll give you a whole day, Grzeszewski says. We sold him to Dortmund's biggest employers for a signing session and made 20,000 euros, which covered a tenth of the budget. Watzke. One of the reasons we got so much out of our players was an extraordinary bond between the players and the club, and between the manager and the players. I know this might sound like a cliche, but we were an extremely tight-knit group. All these players coming back to us is evidence of that. They didn't experience that combination of joy and familiarity, that backing and fairness anywhere else. Sahin and Kagawa both returned to play for Klopp at BVB after unsuccessful spells abroad. Even Götze re-signed with Borussia in 2016, having almost made the move to join up with Klopp in Liverpool. He threw the odd tantrum, but he was also very sensitive and understanding of his players. Everybody appreciated that. Buvac, responsible for the tactical details, continued to enjoy broad support too. Klopp's right-hand man was forced to coach the team for two Champions League group games when his superior was punished with a touchline ban by UEFA. An irate Klopp had screamed, "How many more mistakes do you want to make? One more and it's 15 today!" right into the face of the fourth official, almost dislocating his jaw in anger. Banished from the touchline, he watched the rest of the game on television in the office of the stadium greenkeeper. "My face would have warranted a 5-game ban," he ruefully admitted later. "I don't recognise myself sometimes on the touchline." "We're all happy for Chucky," says Subotic. "He's not an extrovert and the opposition of egotistical. It was cool that he was addressing us for a change." We'd all learned to love him. Klopp's partial absence notwithstanding, Dortmund qualified in the top spot from another tough Champions League group. Arsenal, Napoli, Marseille. During the winter break, they nearly pulled off an even more stunning victory. Making good use of his friendship with Real Madrid president Florentino Perez, Watzke almost thwarted Lewandowski's Bayern move, encouraging Los Merengues to sign him up instead. Lewandowski wavered, but in the end decided to honour his pre-contract agreement with Bayern. His move to the Allianz Arena for the beginning of the 2014-15 season was confirmed on the 4th of January 2014. Hummels' return from injury for the second half of the season, the defender had hurt his knee at the World Cup, immediately brought more stability at the back. Since Dortmund's game was predicted on hitting opponents on the counter-attack, the ability to keep a clean sheet was absolutely vital. When other teams took the lead and could afford to sit back, BVB found it hard to find the space their explosive transition still needed. A steady improvement in domestic results and progress to the Champions League quarter-finals vindicated Klopp's conviction that only details had been missing before Christmas. The team had enough individual and collective quality to finish second behind Bayern, make it to the DFB Pokal final and push Real Madrid very hard in the Champions League. The Spaniards just edged the tie, 3-2 on aggregate, having won the first leg in Madrid 3-0. "You're out, aren't you?" ZDF presenter Joachim Breyer had asked Klopp after the final whistle at the Bernabeu. "How could anyone pay me for doing my job if I stood here saying that we're out already?" Klopp replied, shaking his head in disbelief. My friend Florentino Perez still gets sweaty palms thinking about that first half in Dortmund, in the second leg, Watzke smiles. It was an outstanding quarter-final. On the whole, we hadn't become worse, Bayern had simply become better. Maybe 3 or 5% was missing, but it was okay. And we should have won the cup final, of course. That Hummels goal. A depleted Bayern had lined up with 5 at the back in Berlin to frustrate Dortmund. Klopp's men had destroyed Guardiola's men 3-0 at the Allianz Arena a month earlier. They were the informed team. They had the momentum. An attritional game was heading for stalemate when on 65 minutes, Mats Hummels saw his header cleared from well behind the line by Dante. The referee waved play on and Bayern scored 2 goals in extra time to escape with the trophy in tow. "It was tragic," says Watzke. "A catastrophic refereeing mistake. There's no other word for it. The ball was 35 centimetres behind the line. I don't know another coach who's been this unlucky with refereeing decisions in big finals." Players, officials and the guests at the post-match banquet were so down that Klopp held one of his State of the Nation speeches, decreeing that everybody had to party in recognition of a team that had given their all over the course of 10 months and dealt with all problems, including the worst injury crisis in the history of football, in exemplary fashion. "We would be crazy if we overthrew everything," he added, in reference to the media's misgivings about his regime. "Dortmund's consistency should not be taken for granted. Others don't even celebrate when they win something, but Borussia must be different. If anyone tells me, 'What a shame, tonight,' I'll punch the glass out of their hands without so much as a word. Please enjoy the evening and don't worry, we'll definitely be back. This is a team with a strong backbone. It doesn't matter who they take from us, we'll bring in new guys and everything will be all right." Everything wasn't all right, however. Far from it. 2 months into the 2014-15 season, Dortmund just wouldn't stop losing games in the league. 5 defeats on the trot between late September and early November pulled them down to 17th spot. 18 months after contesting European club football's biggest prize, Klopp's men were heading for Bundesliga 2. No Dortmund team had ever had a worse start to a campaign, not even the side that got relegated in 1971-72. It's a brutal, shitty situation. Crazy, an exasperated Klopp said after the latest defeat 2-1 in Munich. Dortmund had 7 points on the board, 17 fewer than Bayern. Every half-decent domestic result, every win in the Champions League was taken as a clue that the nightmare was about to end. But it never did. At the halfway mark, Borussia's points tally was 15, and they were still 17th in the drop zone. Only goal difference separated them from the worst team in the league, SC Freiburg. Bayern were on 45 points. We're left looking like complete morons here, Klopp said, and we deserve it. As a fresh-faced, occasionally clean-shaven Mainz coach in the second division, Klopp had told his players and the German public that success on the pitch had to be explainable in other words, the result of objectively beneficial, repeatable endeavour. The reason for the disastrous lack of success in his seventh year at BVB proved much harder to ascertain. Because football is a low-scoring game, the distinction between symptoms and ills, between mere bad luck and underlying deficits, often isn't an easy one to make. Did they miss so many chances due to a strength-sapping playing style that seemed stuck in an eternal adolescence, as the Deutsche Zeitung wondered? The contrast with Guardiola's Bayern, who had perfected their own version of pressing to the point that they ran less than anybody else in Germany, was especially painful. Even Watzke noted Dortmund's less economic, more laborious way of playing. A little more than 2 years later, officials, players, and the people closest to Klopp have identified a bucket load of explanations for the crash, some of which are conflicting. All of them, however, continue to have trouble comprehending the sheer ferocity of the slump. It's still an enigma to me, says Watzke. Robert Lewandowski's departure might not have been the single most important factor, but it was something akin to the trigger for the recession. More than anyone else in the team, he could combine hard work with efficiency in front of goal. It was obvious that we couldn't hold on to him anymore, says Dickel. Jürgen knew about the club's financial possibilities. We weren't able or willing to pay somebody 15 million euros in wages a season. I was hoping that Robert would go somewhere else, but everyone knew that he would go. We could only have kept him by selling the town hall. Dortmund had done well to find successors for previous high-profile departures before the Polish forward proved literally irreplaceable. New Italian striker Ciro Immobile, an 18 million euro buy from Torino, had problems adjusting to life in the Ruhr area and to Klopp's system. He couldn't quite make it work in its full complexity yet, Krawitz says. Certain automatisms, synced-up instinctive moves, got lost. Why didn't they field Aubameyang in the centre-forward role instead? The pacey Gabon international was a different kind of striker. Much less physical than Lewandowski, granted, but he could certainly score goals, as the two subsequent seasons under Klopp's successor, Thomas Tuchel, proved. Aubameyang would find the net 79 times in all competitions for BVB, playing through the middle. It was our first grave misjudgment, Watzke says. In the summer of 2014, all of us, especially Jürgen, who was in charge of the lineup, were convinced that Aubameyang was not a number nine. Otherwise, we wouldn't have needed to bother with Immobile at all. Things would probably have worked out differently, it would have been easier, and so on and so on. As it was, 2014-15 was a shit season. Aubameyang is doing very well as a striker now, Krawitz agrees. You could already see back then that he could get you goals, that he was perhaps better suited to playing as a centre-forward than on the wing, as he had problems tracking back. But on the wing is where we needed him at the time. The loss of Lewandowski was indicative of a wider dilemma the club faced, he adds. On the pitch, we had grown much faster than we had developed in terms of our finances. We had young players and players that were bought for little money who performed so well at home and in Europe that they were all of a sudden in a completely different league in terms of their value. The club couldn't keep them. They had to sell them. But at the same time, it was obvious that replacements of equal quality were not available due to the finances. That led to a situation where we could only ever aim to keep our level. We couldn't actually improve. Bayern, meanwhile, were investing smartly and kept developing. Expectations at Dortmund had grown so much that we weren't able to live up to it anymore. Watzke concurs with that macro analysis. The team that we had in 2012 and 2013 would probably have gone on to make the next step if Bayern hadn't started shooting at us this much, he says. That's for sure. We keep rolling the stone up the hill each year like Sisyphus. But you can't complain. You have to live with that if you're Borussia Dortmund. I'd love to be as comfortable financially as Bayern. Unfortunately, we weren't able to grow as much economically in the short space of time as would have been necessary to keep the team together. Watzke and Krawitz also described Germany's World Cup win in Brazil as damaging for Borussia that season. The late arrival of the quintet of internationals, Mats Hummels, Roman Weidenfeller, Matthias Ginter, Kevin Grosskreutz and Eric Durm, caused disruption the coaching staff felt. Krawitz. They had a three-week holiday, which was too short, and wanted to be playing again without having the physical foundation. That ultimately led to us not having the usual confidence in our system. On top of that, systemic errors crept into our defensive game. We were extremely vulnerable to counterattacks. We played games where we enjoyed plenty of possession, created good chances, but lost 1-0 or 2-0 because of a couple of counterattacks. During the season, you have to rely on the basics from pre-season, working in some kind of way. We realised, fucking hell, we really need to change a few things here. We need to practice our movements on the wing and crossing maybe for 2-3 weeks. No time. Or the striker's movement through the middle, to make sure that for once somebody was going to the fucking near post. All we could do is mention that in the video sessions. When it came to a trained impulse to gegenpressing, we weren't able to get that across to make it stick. Psychologically, Dortmund's national team contingent seemed exhausted. Hummels aside, the other four hadn't played in Brazil, but they were right in the middle of this huge hype, Krawitz remembers. Watzke. To put it mildly, the World Cup didn't play a productive role. Our players had hardly featured in Brazil, but they all felt like world champions. Hummels' plight was more mundane, he says. I came back injured and never really recovered my form that season. As captain, my job was to lead by example, but I was too busy trying to get to grips with my own problems. I couldn't be a leader and talk to others from a position of strength because I was playing crap football myself. The outspoken centre-back's customary calmness on the ball and his positive influence on his teammates were badly missed, which was yet another reason for Borussia's fragility. A wave of injuries, coupled with a fixture list that made neither extensive rotation nor detailed tactical repairs possible, exacerbated the crisis. Dortmund's problems didn't add up. They multiplied. We kept losing games in the exact same way, over and over again, says Krawitz. That starts to hurt your confidence as a team after a while. In the Champions League, we did okay. We qualified for the knockout rounds, but that only made us wonder if we were lacking the right attitude in the league. You're in a spiral going round in circles, going down, and we didn't manage to get out of it. We all went crazy, Dickel says. It was impossible to understand. We had 74% possession, 15 shots on goal, they had 2 shots on goal, and we lost 1-0. Week after week, it was horrible. Hummels. We came away thinking, we weren't that bad after every game. You still glance at the third spot on the table and you work out your points difference, you think, we can't go down. And then you're bottom of the table with half the season gone and you'll realise you're in the shit up to your neck. Klopp was visibly affected by the disastrous run. His job was not in danger, Watzke had given him a cast-iron guarantee, but he felt personally responsible. The whole thing drained him. He was in the driving seat, he took it to heart that we were not going in the right direction for some strange reason. I remember looking at him and thinking, oh, he looks really tired and stressed, Subotic recalls. As a guy who's so emotionally involved, you knew it was hitting him very hard, says Hummels. A coach, like any other leading figure, must project self-confidence in order to instill confidence in others. But how can you keep the faith with your ideas if results continue to go the wrong way? Your head is full of questions, says Krawitz. Is it your fault? Is it the team's? What shall we do? It was an extremely shitty situation, more than anyone could really bear. You don't wish that kind of spell on your worst enemy. It was unbelievably exhausting, unbelievably depressing. And at the same time, you're not really allowed to show your emotions. The coaching staff have to be the first ones out there the next morning saying, come on, guys, we go again. Here's what we've done wrong. 2-3 details, and we're back on track. Watzke suggests that sections of the team were maybe not as willing to adhere to Klopp's ideology as before. That total, complete euphoria and passion we had had in the first year wasn't there anymore. That devotion. The players had become older and richer and more successful. Perhaps they wanted to show that things could work at a lower pace, which is not how Jürgen operates. Krawitz sees it a little differently. It wouldn't be fair on the players and their characters to say that they weren't willing or able to play gegenpressing anymore. I can see why some might say that, but it was much more complex than that. Don't get me wrong, we certainly didn't get everything right. Not every decision that we made and that Jürgen was responsible for worked out, but it wasn't as simple as that. Nevertheless, the negative results bred dissent. Some of the more senior players were not shy about making their thoughts known. Exchanges were rather fraught at times, and yet the residual bond and trust between Klopp and his players was strong enough to keep things from breaking completely apart, just about. Whenever he went too far in an argument, he was magnanimous enough to realise that and to apologise either to the player concerned or in front of the whole team, says Hummels. With him, it always came from the heart. That won him our respect in a huge way. But he didn't just say things, he truly felt them. He also could put himself in the shoes of a player. He'd say to me, Mats, I know how you feel, I was a player myself. How can I punish you for that? When we disagreed on something. By contrast, the increasingly embattled coach did not accept outsiders casting doubts on his tactics. He scolded a local reporter for suggesting that other teams might have found out his side and developed strategies for negating Borussia's high-pressing style. I'm not looking for a fight, so I will even answer the stupid questions, he shot back acidly, before going on to claim that Dortmund's plight was all down to their own failings. If you say we've been found out, what does that say about the work of the opposition coaches for the last few years, he added. Were they unable to see what our game is? He maintains that pace cannot be deciphered, that winning games was merely a question of Dortmund playing to their own abilities again. Talking up the progress of the opposition in a league that had blunted his original concept by making it the new orthodoxy would have been counterproductive, he felt. Success was always a question of reconnecting with your own inherent strengths. The right answer was already there. It just needed to be properly implemented. The problem isn't our problem, but the solution is, he insisted. Keeping calm when confronted by a chorus of criticism was tough, especially since he considered most of the negativity unwarranted. Jürgen felt he was getting a raw deal from the media. That was his problem, says Schneck. He felt they didn't treat him right, and so he made up his mind. They have no idea. They need to fill their papers somehow. I remember a game we lost, I think, away to Wolfsburg. He went hell for leather in the press conference. I said to him, mate, that was really shitty. That kind of tone was inappropriate. He goes, leave it out. You're one of those shit journos too. He was irascible, not diplomatic at all. Of course, he later said, sorry, I didn't mean it that way. And I knew him too well to be offended. But his relationship with the media got more and more fractured. Klopp had changed. TV reporters and writers noticed. The lightness and self-deprecating humour that used to season his bluntness were gone, replaced by latent passive aggression, the natural mindset of under-pressure football coaches the world over. Vis-à-vis friends and colleagues, however, people whose loyalty Klopp was assured of, he remained his own dependable self. It would have been easy, for example, in view of Dortmund's tumble down the table, to cancel a talk on motivation that his old buddy Sven Müller had organised in Frankfurt in December 2014, but Klopp had given his word to Müller and turned up. To see someone feeling this bad, sitting here and laughing, that's motivating, isn't it? He told the audience in the hotel ballroom. Throwing in the towel in the Bundesliga was not on his mind, he added. I'm either all in or not at all. Right now, I'm Borussia Dortmund. It's like a marriage. There are good and bad times. Why should the sun be shining out of my arse all the time? Klopp claimed he was a better coach than in 2012 when we were champions. The problem is, that's not reflected in the table. I hear people say that Klopp's no longer himself, that success has gone to his head and so on, but it's all nonsense, Quast says. Those who really know him are aware that not a word of that is true. Quast remembers meeting Klopp at the launch of a new car model at the Opel factory in Rüsselsheim at the height of Dortmund's relegation worries that season. I just had some very bad news about my mother's brain tumour. It was benign, but beyond treatment. Her doctor had also looked after Wolfgang Frank. Klopp says to me, what's wrong? You don't look so good. So I told him the whole story. Quast stops, apologising for the tears in his eyes. Hundreds of Opel employees were there, looking down at him from five stories. 1,000 cameras. Loads of people who all want a piece of Klopp. We were standing a little to the side, but I saw that everybody was staring at us. The photographers went click, click, click. Klopp didn't care about all of that. He just hugged me really tight, not saying a word. Wasn't necessary. Looking back, Dortmund was saved by the bells of Christmas, ringing in a 6-week respite. I don't think we ever thought this is the end of us, but it was so good to get to the winter break, Subotic says. Klopp insisted that the Christmas party should go ahead as planned. There was a time to work and a time to have fun, he told Lindström. And without the latter, one couldn't do the former. He was very good at compartmentalizing things, the BVB team manager says. Krawitz remembers feeling acutely relieved after losing against Bremen, the last game in 2014. We knew we couldn't get any lower. We would spend 6 weeks in the relegation zone, but we had at last a chance to regenerate and practice a few things without the pressure of competitive football. By that time, we had a pretty good idea what was missing in our game, some systematic processes that we hadn't been able to practice. It was clear that with a bit of rest for the legs and the heads, we'd be able to get it right, that this team could function again straight away. That's exactly what happened. Not exactly, or at least not straight away. Dortmund drew 0-0 at Leverkusen in the first game in January, but then lost 1-0 at home to a 10-man Augsburg. Borussia were so bad in their 11th defeat of the season that the most loyal of supporters, those on the yellow wall, shouted at the players in disgust. They were in 18th place now. Hummels and Wiedenfeller tried their best to placate the angry fans, talking with them for a good few minutes through the fence. It would be unacceptable if we didn't understand their frustration about us being bottom after 19 games, says Hummels. The famous BVB togetherness was beginning to crack under the pressure of relegation angst. That was our most difficult moment. The first time I really started fearing for the worst, Watzke says. We felt as if we were in a horror movie. There were rumours that Ottmar Hitzfeld and Lucien Favre had been sounded out to come in as firefighters. But the Dortmund CEO says it was never an option to part ways with Jürgen, even then. Nobody thought about that for 1 second. As Krawitz had thought, the team bounced back. The next 5 games were won. They shot up the table like a belated New Year's rocket. Play, fun, thrill. That's Borussia Dortmund, Klopp said after the 3-0 win in the Ruhr Derby. The slogan was borrowed from a Kinder Surprise ad and referenced Obermeier's and Reus' surprise goal celebration. The black and yellow's dynamic duo dressed up as Batman and Robin on the pitch. Suddenly, qualification for the Champions League looked feasible once more. The official strapline for the second half of the season was Auf und Jagd, race to catch up. Klopp always used these terms. They weren't just empty words, they were an anchor for us, Subotic recalls. People took their cue from it and we made it real. He was brilliant at that. Lunds Sherman, who had listened to hundreds of Klopp's team talks by then, maintains that the coach continued to find words that got under the players' skin. He was able to bring them into line, mesmerizing them. After 7 years, he hadn't lost his ability to squeeze out the best of people. To pick yourself up and come back so strongly is not normal, says Sven Bender. It was only possible because we all pulled together. The coach had to walk through that valley of shadow and the team had to. The club made a noble decision and kept faith with the coach. That's not a given in today's football business. Usually the coach gets axed at this point. His prickly demeanour outside the dressing room notwithstanding, Klopp was still good at lightening the mood with a choice bon mot. We had this osteopath, Heiko, a lovely guy but a little clumsy, Gundogan smiles. Usually he was never on the pitch with the team, but that one day he was there before Kloppo came out. He'd been at the hairdresser's that morning or the day before, and Kloppo looked at him and went, "Will your hairdresser finish cutting your hair tomorrow?" All the players were on the floor laughing. Perfect delivery, even though the mood wasn't that great anymore. The lowest low blow was yet to come. Dortmund had come away with a 2-1 defeat from the first leg against Juventus in Italy in the Champions League. An almost perfect result, said Klopp. A huge fan choreography before kick-off in the Signal in Iduna Park summoned the spirit of the past. Dortmund had won the European Cup against the old lady in 1997, and togetherness. But when Carlos Tevez scored after 3 minutes for the visitors, Dortmund were rendered completely helpless, dying a slow 87-minute-long death out on the pitch. They created next to nothing and conceded 2 more at the back. Their football was almost invisible, as the Deutsche Zeitung noted after the demoralising 3-0 defeat. The manner of the capitulation left no doubt. Klopp's BVB team weren't just out of Europe. They were over. The club will have to bid farewell to old habits, to nostalgic glorification, and to taboos. The Munich-based broadsheet added. The coach will have to give shape to a new vision of football. The coach or a coach. Watzke, Zorc and Klopp met in Watzke's office not long after Easter. We all had this feeling of trepidation, Watzke says. In principle, we all knew that it would be better if we finished it. But Michael and me couldn't say it. Eventually, Jürgen said, "Listen, we're all thinking the same here, aren't we? I'll tell you now, I'll go. We had agreed that things had run their course. It wasn't a case of his effect on the team having worn off or anything like that, but 7 years was a very long time. We'd felt it for a while. No one had dared to admit it,